From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, the conservative roots of healthcare's individual mandate.
I'm a little surprised that this feature, which we thought is kind of an afterthought, has become so prominent.
We'll trace the individual mandate back to the early 1990s, when it was Republicans who introduced the idea in Congress. We'll hear from Bob Bennett, who was one of those GOP senators. Also, getting your kids into preschool is becoming more difficult. One is now requiring applicants to submit to a DNA test.
Simple DNA testing can determine whether a child will end up at Yale or at Yonkers Community College.
Plus, more of our favorite three-minute fiction submissions so far, the New Testament scholar who answers the question, did Jesus exist? The life and music of James Brown and Noel Gallagher on sibling rivalry and life after Oasis.
My outlook has never changed. It's like I'm still living someone else's dream.
That's all in this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. At some point yesterday, the nine justices of the Supreme Court gathered in a conference room for a closed meeting. And according to protocol, Elena Kagan, the junior-most justice, manned the door. And one by one, they spoke up. Yes or no, whether to uphold or to overturn the Affordable Care Act, what's come to be known as Obamacare. And even though its fate may have already been decided, we won't find out until the ruling comes down, possibly in June. Our cover story today, is the Obama health plan doomed? And if so, what happens next? At the Supreme Court this week, some of the justices were tough on the administration's top lawyer, Donald Verrilli, when it came to the issue of the individual mandate, the part of the law that'll require almost every American to have health insurance.
Why aren't those problems that the federal government can address directly?
Can you create commerce in order to regulate it?
If I'm in any market at all, my failure to purchase something in that market subjects me to regulation.
No, that's not our position at all, Justice Scalia.
It was a tense day for Verrilli.
Excuse me.
To say the least.
But what's making you reluctant?
I'm not trying to be reluctant. I understand how this works. I'm trying to be careful about...
Now, despite the awkward moments, no one can say what the eventual outcome will be either way, including Reed Cherlin. For him, this past week was a dose of deja vu. Reed, introduce yourself for us, please.
My name is Reed Cherlin. I was a spokesman at the White House from the day after Inauguration Day until March of last year.
Reed Cherlin was the president's chief spokesman on health care. He didn't have to defend the law in front of the Supreme Court, but he says that didn't make his job any easier.
Answering questions about the bill, no matter what the questions are, is extremely difficult because it's so complicated. The relationship of the American people to their health care coverage is just extremely tricky. They generally don't like the system. They are very skeptical of the players, but they would rather not have to deal with it than have anything change. And the minute you even say something like, you know, under Obamacare, you'd have to do X, Y, and Z, no one wants to do anything with their health care. They just want it to be there, and they want to not get sick.
A couple days ago, in a blog post for GQ magazine, Reed Cherlin posted some of the quotes he gave to reporters about the law, and he called them horrible and torturous. I have a couple of them in front of me. Can you read some of them?
Sure. The president has made it clear that health insurance reform legislation should prevent insurance companies from placing annual limits on health expenditures that can force families into financial ruin. We will continue to work with Congress on this policy.
Now, Reed Cherlin says it was that kind of language that made it so hard to make the case for the Obama plan. And in hindsight, he says the White House didn't do itself any favors.
Originally, you know, particularly on the campaign, you want to talk about covering everyone. Then it was about cutting costs. Then it's about cutting the deficit. There are a lot of good things that it does, but for a bumper sticker or for a 15-second blurb, basically you've got to pick one. There was a lot of disagreement and evolution about which one we should be talking about, and so consequently, probably nothing stuck.
So what did stick with Americans? To find out, we sent producers out to three places this week: Roanoke, Virginia, Fort Myers, Florida, and Huntersville, North Carolina, all battleground states this election year. And we asked this question: if the High Court upholds the Affordable Care Act, how do you think it'll affect you?
It's going to take away from us senior citizens to give to somebody else, who half these people are on drugs and whatnot, and I don't want to be paying for them.
I don't believe in a government tells me I should buy insurance or I have to buy insurance. I think the government's got too damn much control over what we're doing right now.
I think the idea behind it is a good idea. I'm still on my parents' plan since I'm 24 and I can stay on that till I'm 26 now.
And they are trying to cut back onto insurance, and I don't think that's fair because there's a lot of elderly people that need it.
When they have a 2,000-page bill and they pass it without reading it, I think that's ludicrous.
I mean, I think the government is just making way too many decisions for us as American citizens.
It's really hard to pay for otherwise, and it is a basic right for all of us to be capable of being well, so I think it's a great idea.
You know, like I said, I think everybody got to chip in. I don't want to be paying for you. You got to help yourself out. Everybody got to do their part.
Why not?
Should not be mandatory to make someone buy health insurance if they can pay their own bills.
It scares me to think that I will have to buy a certain type of insurance from the government and that my coverage will be as they deem it to be.
Do you have health insurance now?
Yes.
Now, some of what you heard is accurate and some isn't. And every single person you just heard, by the way, told us they already have health insurance, either through Medicare, Medicaid, an employer plan, a private plan. And so it's unlikely the Affordable Care Act would affect any of them. But given that everyone in America will be required to have health insurance, how many people will have to buy it? Here's NPR health policy correspondent Julie Ravner.
The short answer is a whole lot fewer than may think so.
Uh-huh.
And this is not to suggest that people don't have a legitimate right to be worried about government intrusion into the healthcare system. But the best way to think about it is think about the people who are not affected. Almost every senior has Medicare.
Right.
Poor people have Medicaid, and under this law, a lot more low-income people will have Medicaid. If you get insurance at work, you will not be affected by this, and there are provisions to make sure your employer does not drop that. By the time all is said and done, we're talking about 18 million people who would be required to go out and get insurance. Of those 18 million people, about 11 million would then have subsidies, would be given money by the government to help them pay for it. So in the end, we're talking of 300 million some Americans. We're talking about 7 million who would have to go out on their own dime and have to buy insurance.
Okay, let's talk about the possible scenarios. If the Supreme Court, say, strikes down just the individual mandate part of the Affordable Care Act, what happens then? Does the whole thing fall apart?
Well, if they were to strike down the mandate alone, which is what one of the appeals courts did, that would be a big problem for the insurance industry if they still had to go out and sell to people with pre-existing conditions.
Because their argument is the only way to make it affordable is that if everybody has to buy it.
Right. Now, if they were to do what the government asks and strike down the individual mandate and the requirement to sell to people with pre-existing conditions at those prices, there are ways to get around that. There are other things you could do. Medicare, for instance, says if you don't sign up right away for the voluntary part, you would have to pay more later. That's one possibility. So it depends how they would strike it down.
Let's talk about the overall law. If the whole thing is thrown out, is overturned by the Supreme Court, what then?
I've talked to a number of lawyers this week, and their responses have ranged from bedlam to chaos.
Hmm.
Even people who would like for the court to do that have suggested there would be some dislocation. Remember, you've got hundreds of thousands of small businesses who are already getting tax credits. You've got 2.5 million young people who are staying on their parents' health plans. You've got 50,000 people on these new temporary plans for people with pre-existing conditions. Most of that stuff would stop. How long it would take for some of the funding to shut off is a question that we will have to see. Remember, the court has not overturned a law of this magnitude in 75 years, not since the New Deal. So this is really uncharted territory we're talking about.
Does the White House have a plan B in place if this is thrown out?
The White House insists that it doesn't. There are people on Capitol Hill who are talking about a plan B, but Congress can't get anything done, certainly this year. If they would have to come back and do something else, it would be next year at the soonest.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Julie Ravner. Now, the idea of an individual mandate to control health care costs isn't new. In fact, it goes back to 1989. Mark Pauley, an expert on healthcare policy, was part of a group of academics brought to the White House by President George H.W. Bush. Their task? Fix healthcare. And their solution? Let the marketplace solve it. Make everyone buy insurance on the open market. And at the time, many Republicans loved it, including the president. So the White House decided to take it to Congress.
Legislation was drafted, but never made it as a bill, because the word from the Democrats in Congress was it would be dead on arrival.
Dead on arrival.
Correct.
Was your plan popular with Republicans at the time?
As far as I know, it was. There was certainly a lot of interest in it. And because I guess it captured the idea of limiting government to helping those who need help and not having it interfere with the decisions of people who could afford adequate insurance coverage on their own.
Effectively, what you proposed back in 1989 was an individual mandate. It was somewhat different than the one that Democrats passed with the Affordable Care Act. But that is the dividing line now. That is what opponents really object to, the individual mandate. They probably would have objected to your plan if it was passed, don't you think?
Maybe so. Although I think the reason that the individual mandate has come front and center is because it's an objection that can be cast in the form of a constitutional challenge. So to some extent, I'm a little surprised that this feature, which we thought is kind of an afterthought, has become so prominent. But the current individual mandate, in my view, is kind of a puny thing because the penalties are relatively small compared to the premium you'd have to pay if you bought the minimum qualified coverage.
Although that does go up. The penalty does go up every year.
But even so, the maximum is about $2,000. But our mandate was much stronger. It basically said if you didn't show that you'd arranged coverage which met at least this minimum, you'd pay a penalty equal to the premium for the cheapest qualified coverage, and you'd automatically be assigned to a fallback insurer that the government would contract with.
So your plan sounds like it would have been a real lightning rod today. I mean, if your enforcement standards were even stricter than the one proposed by the Democrats.
Well, except that the insurance that you had to buy was a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. What's being mandated under the current legislation is much more elaborate than what we had in mind. I think the controversy over the contraception and inclusion of that is a kind of example of the sort of thing that's different now than it would have been under our arrangement.
So should I assume that you oppose the health care law that was passed by Democrats 2 years ago?
My own personal view is it's better than nothing, and we could work with it to fix it up. But the fundamental contours of the subsidy part of it are obviously something I'm very much in favor of.
Mark Pauly, known as the intellectual father of the individual mandate. Now, while his plan may have been dead on arrival in 1989, it did eventually make it to the Senate floor in the form of a bill, an idea proposed by Republicans as an alternative to President Bill Clinton's health care plan. And in a moment, we'll speak with one of those Republicans who co-sponsored the bill, former Utah Senator Bob Bennett. Before the break, we mentioned the individual mandate in health care. Now, not so long ago, most Democrats hated the idea, and most of its support came from Republicans. And it started with President Bill Clinton's attempt to reform the health care system back in 1993. He came to Capitol Hill to address Congress.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it.
Sitting in the chamber that night, a newly elected Republican senator from Utah, Bob Bennett.
I listened to his statement and said to myself, I could make that speech. I agree with everything he's just said. But I also realized at the end of the speech that it was all diagnosis and no prescription.
So a few months later, Bennett and about 20 other Republicans set out to offer up an alternative plan to what they disparagingly called Hillary Care, after then-First Lady Hillary Clinton, who wrote the White House plan. And part of the Republican prescription was the individual mandate. It was even supported by the Republican leader, Bob Dole. And just two Democrats backed it.
The objection to the individual mandate did not arise really until after Obamacare was written.
Did a lot of Republicans like it back in 93 when you were part of this group that introduced it in the Senate?
I'm assuming that they did.
Of course, the Heritage Foundation and other conservative organizations liked this idea. They thought, you know, there shouldn't be freeloaders, right? That everybody should have to pay for their health care because if you have a heart attack and you get rushed to the emergency room, you're not going to be left for dead in America. Someone is going to take care of you. The question is, who's going to pay that bill? That was
the
argument.
That is, what you have described is currently the law. So we now have on the books a law that says someone can get health care and thumb his or her nose at the emergency room and walking out and say, I have no coverage. I'm not going to pay this, and there's basically nothing you can do about it. And if people have an economic incentive to overuse emergency room health care, sometimes jam it up with items that are clearly not emergencies, but they go to the emergency room simply because they know they can get free care, there's an economic cost and there's a fairness argument. So that's why I embraced it.
Senator Bennett, you oppose the Affordable Care Act. This is something you voted against.
Yes.
That, of course, the heart of the Affordable Care Act is the individual mandate. So why did you oppose it?
Well, your comment has just demonstrated one of the problems with this whole debate and how it's been distorted by having the individual mandate emerge as the litmus test, the binary switch that is either on or off about whether or not this is good legislation. I'm not opposed to the individual mandate, but I still think the bill is a terrible piece of legislation. The accounting simply does not add up. You look at the way Harry Reid, for whom I have admiration, because he was under pressure from the White House to get it passed, regardless of what it said. Well, I cared about the details because I looked at the accounting, I looked at the costs, I looked at the devastation it would occur on states and the impact it would have on Medicare and all of the other things that were wrong with it. And frankly, I never even thought about the individual mandate as I voted against it.
That's Bob Bennett, former Republican senator from Utah. He served in the Senate from 1993 until 2011, and he spoke to us from Salt Lake City. Senator Bennett, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Turning now to another story we've been following, this one in Manhattan, where the competition among affluent parents to get their kids into private preschools has reached a new extreme. Now, for years, New York parents have been applying to preschools even before their youngsters are born. That's not new. But what is new is an approach one prestigious preschool on the Upper West Side is taking. All applicants must now submit to DNA analysis of their children. So we went to find out more.
So over here on the left, as you can see, we have an art room.
This is the Porcifillo Preschool Academy, or Porcifillo Pre, as it's known. On a recent afternoon, Headmaster Rebecca Unson walked me through the modern glass and steel building. It was designed by I.M. Pei, and it's located in a leafy corner of the Upper West Side.
Over here we have computer labs. C++ learning is the language of computers.
You're telling me that the preschoolers here are learning C++.
Oh, absolutely they are, and they're very good at it.
Not only C++, but all the children are enrolled in a Mandarin Chinese immersion program. 12,000 applications pour into Unson's office each fall. 12,000 hopefuls for just 32 spots a year. It makes Porcifillo Pre the most competitive preschool in America. So in a bid to weed out the kids who have no chance, the school decided to require a DNA test for all applicants. Unson's team is looking for genetic markers that indicate future excellence, things like intelligence and confidence and other leadership traits. Now, before she joined the school in 2009, Unson was a child neurologist. She was hired specifically to implement this new policy.
Well, we now know that simple DNA testing can determine whether a child will end up at Yale or at Yonkers Community College.
And one expectant couple has gone to great lengths to get their future child a spot at Porcifillo.
My name is Richard Tromper.
And I'm his wife, Elizabeth Tauschen.
We met up with Richard and Elizabeth at the New Amsterdam Memorial Hospital. Elizabeth is 24 weeks pregnant. The couple is applying for admission to Porcifillo for the fall of 2015. And they're here at the hospital for a DNA test.
I went to Princeton. I was lucky. I mean, I got in Princeton. I worked hard. But when our child gets into this preschool, he or she is going. It's the express lane.
It's a one-way ticket to success.
Elizabeth will have a blood test. Scientists will isolate her unborn baby's DNA, analyze it, and then pass that along to the admissions office at Porcifillo.
Elizabeth Tauschen.
You ready?
I guess I have to be.
All right.
The school has an exclusive agreement with this hospital. The couple is taken into a room beside the lab, and blood is drawn.
Okay, hold steady now.
The vial of blood is then escorted immediately into the lab. About a month later, the results will be delivered back to the school. Some parents are already planning to take legal action against the school in the event their children are passed over. And a recent op-ed in the New York Times called the practice ghoulish and unethical. Headmaster Rebecca Unson dismisses that criticism.
This is not unethical at all. If anything, it's extremely ethical. This is now no longer a subjective decision. This is a clinical test that can show us how a child will perform throughout its life.
The Porcifilla Preschool Academy will begin to accept applications under their new DNA policy today, April 1st. More than 6,000 stories came in this round of 3-Minute Fiction. 6,000! Amazing. The challenge this time, the story had to begin with a sentence, she closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. It's going to take us several weeks to read through those stories and find a winner, but for now, here are a few samples of what some of you did with that sentence.
She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. I sucked in a full exchange of air, and my stupefaction began to lift. Oh, God, did she respond to my note? She'd been sitting there long enough, but my study Carol stakeout afforded only intermittent glimpses beyond the long dark hair that draped over the back of her seat. As soon as she was safely outside the building, I sauntered past the table and scooped up the book with hands as moist as squid sashimi. Back at my study, Carol, I wiped my palms on my jeans and anxiously flipped open the copy of Coastal Climatology that she'd been reading. There was my awkward calling card, scrawled in the featureless print preferred by secret admirers worldwide. Hi there. Sorry if this seems weird. I've seen you around the university library quite a bit. I'm curious to know who you are and where you're from. Nothing. She'd left no reply.
A week before, she said, "Can I have a book instead of the meal?" "You have books," I said. She always had books, always read. She worked at the small library they had here. "Not those," she said. "A new book from a store. Will you get one for me? Soon?" She had never asked me for anything before, and I was so surprised that I blushed. I thought she'd want a classic like Moby Dick, but she gave me the names of a few authors and said to get anything by any of them. They wrote romance novels, cheap paperback romance novels. "Did you do it?" I asked her once. She looked at me a long time with her cool green eyes, then shrugged the slightest of shrugs, a shrug that took in the 8x10 cell with the bed and table and toilet, the 14 years, the 2 appeals, the scar on her cheek that had faded with time, a shrug that was equal parts, "What do you think?" and "Apparently so."
That was our Susan Stamberg reading the story Exit by Richard Bader of Towson, Maryland, and also our Bob Mondello with an excerpt from The Dewey Decimal Suitor by Stephen Bismarck of Medford, Oregon. To read full versions of these stories, go to npr.org/3-minute-fiction. That's all spelled out, no spaces. Listen for more stories next weekend, and soon we'll check in with our judge, Luis Alberto Urrea, to see what he thinks of the entries so far. There are probably few people in the world who know more about the life of Jesus than Bart Ehrman. He's a New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where his lectures are among the most popular on campus. And though Ehrman's not a particularly religious man, he's often puzzled by a question he gets asked. Did Jesus exist? So he decided to answer that question in his new book, and fittingly, it's also called Did Jesus Exist? Bart Ehrman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with a premise of your question, because I hope I'm not giving anything away. Your answer is yes, Jesus did exist.
Yes, that's right.
You don't have to get to the end of the book to get to that answer. But why did you feel like the question needed to be answered at all? I mean, is it in serious dispute?
The deal is that every week I get two or three emails from people asking me, did Jesus exist? And as I started doing some looking into the matter, I realized there is a large contingent of people, largely on the internet, but also writing books, claiming that, in fact, Jesus never did exist, that he was completely made up by the early Christians. And I wanted to approach that question as a historian to see whether that's right or not.
These are people you call mythicists, or I guess they call themselves mythicists. So what is the argument that they make?
Well, there are several arguments that when you just look at them plainly, they look fairly plausible. Jesus is never mentioned in any Roman source of his day. There's no archaeological evidence that Jesus ever existed, no physical proof. And the Christian sources are problematic because the Gospels are 20, 40, 50, 60 years later. Mm. On the other side of the ledger, they point out that many of the things said about Jesus are said about pagan divine beings or pagan gods.
That there was this guy who was a person who was crucified and resurrected.
Did miracles, cast out demons,
raised on water.
The dead. And most importantly, they point out that there are pagan gods who are said to die and rise again. Hmm. And so the idea is that Jesus was made up as a Jewish God who died and rose again. And so when you simply look at it without any context, it looks like a plausible argument.
Why do you think it is implausible then?
A lot of the arguments don't really count for anything. I mean, the fact there's no archaeological evidence for Jesus doesn't really matter because there's not archaeological evidence for hardly anybody who lived in this world.
Moses, Abraham, on and on.
Well, or the 60 million people who lived in Jesus' day. So what I do in the book is I marshal all of the evidence. The Gospels were written 40 or 50 years after Jesus, but they incorporate earlier written sources, and they're all reliant on oral traditions. Mm. And you can actually translate some of these Greek traditions in the Gospels back into the original Aramaic of Jesus, and they make better sense, which means these were traditions floating around in Palestine probably just a few years after Jesus'
death. And we
death.
Should just make it clear. I mean, the Gospels, according to scholars, these are not eyewitness accounts. I mean, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written long after Jesus died.
That's right. They're all anonymous, in fact. It was only about 100 years later that people said they were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Hmm. So they're written by Greek-speaking Christians living decades later. Moreover, we have the writings of the Apostle Paul, who was writing before the Gospels and who converted to be a follower of Jesus just a year or two after the traditional date of his death.
He knew Jesus' brother James.
Yeah, Paul knew Jesus' brother James, and he knew his closest disciple Peter, and he tells us that he did. And if Jesus didn't exist, you would think his brother would know about it. So I think Paul probably is pretty good evidence that Jesus at least existed.
You contend that had he actually been invented by pagans at the time, they would have turned him into this powerful figure of grandeur that was like shooting laser beams out of his fingers rather than a man who was crucified.
The Messiah was supposed to overthrow the enemies.
Right.
And so if you're going to make up a Messiah, you'd make up a powerful Messiah.
Like a superhero.
A superhero. You wouldn't make up somebody who was humiliated, tortured, and then killed by the enemies.
My guest is Bart Ehrman. He's a professor of religious studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's got a new book out. It's called Did Jesus Exist? And if you're wondering what the answer is, it is yes. Bart, a few years ago, I downloaded a series of lectures that, you know, are available in these, like you see these ads in magazines, great courses, right? And I downloaded your series of lectures on the life of the historical Jesus. And a lot of people listening will know you. I mean, you are the guy, you're the expert on the life of the historical Jesus. So how are we able to build as accurate an account of his life from the existing material?
One of the things I argue is that historians come away with a different view of Jesus from what is popular in the wider culture. So that Jesus doesn't really look like the Jesus you might have learned about in Sunday school or that you hear from a televangelist.
You say he wouldn't recognize himself if he heard that.
No, he wouldn't.
You write that in the book.
He most definitely would not recognize himself if he turned on TV on Sunday morning. Jesus, according to the majority of scholars in North America, Europe, was some kind of Jewish apocalyptic prophet. By which I mean that Jesus believed he was living in an evil age controlled by the forces of evil, but that God was soon going to intervene to overthrow the forces of evil and set up a good kingdom on earth, a good utopian kingdom where there'd be no more pain, misery, or suffering. And this cataclysmic break in history was going to happen within his own generation.
We are, of course, speaking on Palm Sunday, Bart. And as a scholar, how do you sort of begin to assess and analyze what you think is true and what you don't think is true?
Yes. Well, at this point, the mythicists have some right things to say. The Gospels do portray Jesus in ways that are non-historical. There is absolutely non-historical material in the Gospels, as we know, because there are contradictions in the Gospels and discrepancies in the Gospels and completely implausible events in the Gospel. As an example, the idea that's being celebrated on Palm Sunday, that Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey and all the crowds came out crying out, "Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," celebrating the coming of the Messiah to Jerusalem. If that had really happened the way it's described in the Gospels, there's no way to explain why the Romans didn't have Jesus arrested on the spot. In the Gospels, Jesus spends another week in Jerusalem preaching to the crowds. But anybody who calls himself a Messiah is making a political statement.
He would have been arrested right away.
He would have been arrested right away. And so probably the event would have been a much smaller, toned-down version from what you get in the Gospels. Jesus certainly came to Jerusalem the last week of his life, and he ended up being crucified there. There's no doubt about that. But the way it's celebrated in the Gospels simply is not plausible historically.
Bart, a lot of people listening will know you as a well-known scholar of early Christianity. You are controversial. I should point this out because you are something of a lapsed Christian yourself. You've been described as an agnostic. Is that fairly
accurate?
Yes,
that's right.
So what is your relationship with Jesus about? I mean, is it historian to historical figure? Is there any part of it that is spiritual?
Most of it is historical. Jesus is the most important figure in the history of Western civilization. And so people ask me, well, why would you be interested in somebody you don't believe in? I mean, he's tremendously important. So,
Is Jesus to you what Lincoln is to Doris Kearns Goodwin or, you know?
to a large extent, although I must say that I continue to be attracted by the teachings of Jesus. Jesus' teachings of love and mercy and forgiveness, I think, really should dominate our lives, that it really is better to love your neighbor as yourself. On the personal level, I agree with many of the ethical teachings of Jesus, and I try to model my life on them, even though I don't agree with the apocalyptic framework in which they were put.
That's Bart Ehrman. He's professor of religious studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is called Did Jesus Exist? Bart joined me here in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much for coming in, Bart Ehrman. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And it's time now for music. Wow, I feel good. James Brown. I knew that I wouldn't. Enough said. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. James Brown's music is known around the world. His story, less so. Biographer R.J. Smith has just released an eye-opening account of Brown's rise and eventual downfall in the book The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. As Smith writes, James Brown's worldview was shaped by a story he'd been told as a child, that he'd been born dead and miraculously brought back to life.
He was somebody who should not have been alive. He was born under a bad sign, as the bluesmen say, and he had that vibe with him, I think.
He believed he was indestructible, you write.
He, having been born dead, having been through as much in his life as he went through, criminal experiences, been up and down with the music industry, made millions, lost millions. I think on some level he felt whatever happened, happened, and he couldn't die. He was indestructible.
His life story, as it becomes very clear earlier in your book, is made for a film. He's this incredibly difficult upbringing in Augusta, Georgia. His father was unbelievably violent. His mother left. James Brown ended up in trouble all the time for stealing or fighting. He spends time in prison.
Yeah.
In fact, in prison, he becomes the guy that he eventually would be.
Absolutely. I think he heard a lot of music in prison. I think he heard a lot of gospel that he was listening to before, but never so much as when he was in prison with a radio stuck to his head. They called him Music Box in prison as a teenager. And he was in a gospel group when he was in prison. And he started to understand singing gospel, what power he had over an audience. Help me, help me. I'm so weak. Gee whiz, I love you. I'm so weak. I love you tomorrow. I love someone.
Tell me about the early days of his career in the 1950s we're talking about. He's in the South, the segregated South. Who's going to see his shows? How is he getting attention?
Yeah, any way he can, he's getting attention. It would be people who worked hard for a living, African Americans, almost exclusively, for sure, on what sometimes gets called the Chitlin Circuit. Barns and huts and shacks and, you know, trashed out spaces that got cleaned out fast, and they put up a little stage and they had a show that night. And those are audiences that were desperate to be entertained. They spent their hard-earned dollar, and if you didn't entertain them, they would let you know fast.
His first big hit was a song called
Please, 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 Please.
You write that this is really where James Brown separates himself from the other R&B singers at the time.
You know, there's something misleadingly familiar and almost generic about it. It's a doo-wop vocal harmony song. But the way that he sings it, over the top with emotion, he was losing something important to him, and you can feel it. All he can do is repeat that word over and over, 26 times, I think. He took it over the top.
Now you go home.
I'm speaking with R.J. Smith. He's written a new biography of James Brown, and it's called The One. R.J., the title of your book refers to the beat that gives funk its character. Describe what The One is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, The One, in a way, is the essence of James Brown. It's a musical term on one level. It's about that first beat of the measure that Brown wanted emphasized at all times. And I think it had to do with wanting to come in strong and fast in a song. I think a lot of pop music was emphasizing the two and the four. He came in hard from the beginning. He wanted to get your attention right away.
You call the song Mother Popcorn the sound of The One.
You can feel the weight of the first beat in that measure. It's like a wrecking ball hitting on that one.
Say, you got to have a mother for me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on.
But beyond that, I think The One was a philosophical thing to him. He would talk about living in The One and feeling The One, being in The One. And it has to do with living in the moment, inhabiting the space around you. It's all you've got is this moment. Who knows what will happen later? You got to be with The One.
As James Brown became more and more famous, his political consciousness develops more deeply. Eventually, he gets involved in the Black Power movement. Tell me about his political activity.
His politics were a mess. Here was somebody who endorsed Hubert Humphrey when he was running against Richard Nixon. And then when Nixon got the nomination and the victory, he quickly endorsed Richard Nixon and supported him. He was somebody who was all over the map. He wanted to change things. He felt an intense feeling of responsibility to his audience, to African Americans everywhere. And here's someone who said, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. At the same time, he was both aligned with Black Panthers and Black Power ideas and very critical of them. He came at it his own way.
You interviewed more than 100 people who knew James Brown and who were in his orbit. What kind of person was he? I mean, how did people describe him on a personal level?
You know, what was interesting to me was whoever I talked to, whether they really wanted to talk or didn't tell me everything they knew.
Right.
Because James Brown was a complicated, a dangerous individual to be around. He frightened people. And people saw things and heard things they wish they hadn't.
When you say dangerous and he frightened people, how so?
Well, he was somebody who knew how to use his fists. As a teenager, he was a boxer. He thought about pursuing that. When he becomes a musician and is on that course in his life, He's still using his fists. He's using his fists to get what he wants from the musicians in his band. He's using his fists to become the leader of the band. That wasn't a given at the beginning. He uses fists many times against the women in his life.
Of course, and domestic violence was always in the backdrop in his life. His financial affairs were a mess. He fathered lots of children. He had no intention of raising. I mean, this is, as you say, this is a complicated person. He was at one point hooked on PCP.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one thing that I hope I have done in the book is that I think late in his life, when a lot of this stuff was coming out, when he went back to prison, I think he became, to some people, a joke. And as someone they could mock freely. That's horrible. Things that he did in his life, clearly, he was not proud of, and they were wrong, and he often paid a price for them. But they come in a context of a life of someone who grew up incredibly abused himself, violence done to him. He was a human being who had experiences that made him the person he grew up to be.
What is his legacy?
His legacy is, as a performer, he's never been topped. Every decade he lived in, he changed the sounds around him. Nobody since him has approached him on the level of ability to control an audience, to shape their feelings, to bring every aspect of performing together for hours at a time.
One, two, three, four. Get up, get on up.
R.J. Smith is the author of the book The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. You can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org. R.J. Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Stay on the scene. Get on up like a sex machine. Get on up. Get up. Get on up. Stay on the scene. Get on up like a sex machine. Get on up. Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm.
I need to be myself.
At its height in the mid-1990s, the British band Oasis was the biggest rock act in the world. Bigger than U2, bigger even, some argued, than the Beatles. And at the heart of Oasis, two volatile personalities who happened to be brothers, Noel and Liam Gallagher. Noel, the main songwriter, and Liam, the lead singer. Here's a sample of how they got on.
He's my
No,
he's been
Well, you've been running on about, right? For what?
You've been
for
rock and roll.
No, it's getting arrested. Rock and roll is about being yourself, and I want
no,
a fucking boat and a drink and a
rock and roll's about music.
And with their fiery tempers and very public spats, the Gallagher brothers made the covers of tabloids as often as they topped the pop charts. But one night, 3 years ago, Oasis burned out, and it happened suddenly, a now famous meltdown backstage before a show. Oasis never performed that night. The estranged brothers went their separate ways. Liam started his own band, so did Noel. His band's called Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. Last week, Noel Gallagher stopped by our studios to talk about the new record, fatherhood, sibling rivalry, and of course, Oasis. The day after his old band split, a message from Noel on their website read, "I simply could not go on working with Liam a day longer."
Well, that's my manager, actually. That was his state, because I quit and I went and that was it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get hold of me for days. I'd hired a private jet and took my wife and children off to the south of France, like proper rock stars do. The reason that I left was because I didn't see much of, after what, I don't want to really go into specifics about what was said and blah, blah, blah and all that, but in a moment of clarity, I thought that there is no future in this. And I wish I'd have stayed and done the gig. We were backstage waiting to go on stage.
And this is in
to
Paris.
30,000 people in Paris. And as the tour manager came in and said, 5 minutes, you know, we broke up within that 5 minutes. I'm not proud of that, but, you know, all things come to an end, and I think the level of success that Liam's and Gem's and Andy's new band have had BDI, and what I'm doing now proves that it was the right decision for everyone. You know, everybody's a lot happier. And I think it was the right thing. It was certainly the right thing for me to do.
I remember seeing you perform at the Boston Orpheum in 1995 when Morning Glory came out, which was a huge record. And it was an amazing show, but it was also this time when, you know, your performances were erratic. I mean, your brother didn't finish the show. He was drunk. He couldn't finish it. You finished it beautifully, and you sang most of the songs that people came to hear. But it was clear that something wasn't right at that time.
We all dealt with that level of success and fame in different ways. When the album took off in America, that album Morning Glory, it was everything that I'd expected. So I knew how I was going to deal with it all. My outlook has never changed. It's like I'm still living someone else's dream. This is the best thing in the world, you know, and long may it continue. It's like, why do you think the Rolling Stones are still doing it at 100, at a combined age of 1,050? It's because it's the best thing in the world.
You and your brother, you have two brothers, and you were essentially raised by a single mom because your dad left when you were a kid.
Yeah.
You grew up in a council estate, what we would call a housing project. Not an easy upbringing in Manchester.
No, but at the time, my mum and all my aunties and my cousins all lived within the same 5-mile radius. They worked in factories. So your whole world is there. So you don't know there's another world outside of this where people are middle class and stuff like that. So at the time, it wasn't a hard life. That was just life. But, you know, that gave you something else. That gave you a toughness in a sense that, you know, if I'm on the tour bus in America and, you know, I've got to go to another show and I'm not feeling too well, I just think back to those days and think, well, you know, I lived in a house with bare floorboards, right? Before bare floorboards were trendy.
Mom still lives there, right?
She still lives in the same house. She's got carpet now, though, obviously. But she still lives in the same house.
You were married a few years ago. Your wife is, her name is Sarah. You've got two children, right?
I was married last summer.
Last summer. I'm sorry. But you were together for so long that I...
You've been together for 12 years. Yeah. I've got two boys.
One is about four. One is a little bit more than one, right?
One is four and one is one and a bit, yes.
Given that you really didn't grow up with a dad... How did you learn how to be a father?
I don't think you ever learn. I just think you kind of... There are lots of books when you go into bookshops about parenting.
Yes, there are.
None of them are warranted, and none of them is the Bible or the truth, because really, there are no set rules. You just bumble along, and hopefully, you know, you just love your children. Ronnie Wood said that to me once. Sorry to name drop, but I was at a party at Ronnie Wood's house, right? And
was at
his 50th.
Yeah.
He had kids, loads of kids, and he just said, the one thing you do is just love them. Everything else comes from that. That's it. And it's a beautiful hippie 60s attitude, but it's true. Mm. I mean, I'm luckily enough, the worst thing I've got to say is when I'm packing to leave... And my older lad can sense what's
going on. Yeah, you're gone this time around for like 7 weeks.
Yeah, and then when the cases are going in the car, he starts grabbing your ankles and going, "No, Dad," you know, that is really tough. But you have to say to him, "Look, just the longer I'm away, the more toys you're going to get when I come back." And he's like, "Oh,"
and they're like, great toys in America.
Well, he thinks I've convinced him, which I didn't realize this would come back to haunt me, but. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles making this record. I was there for about 3 months on and off. And every time I came back, I'd bring him more toys. And I told him as a joke one night that Los Angeles was where they made all the toys in the world. He's coming to Los Angeles for the first time in his life on holiday. And he's going, "Los Angeles, that's where they make all the toys." And I was like, "Really, you told you that?" And he said, "You told me that's where they make all these toys." And I was like, and he said, "Can we go to the place where they make them?" I might have told him I knew the guy that made the toys. And I was like, well, strictly that's not true. They do sell a lot of toys in Los Angeles. They sell them, you know, but he's going to have the time of his life, I think.
I'm speaking with Noel Gallagher, formerly of the band Oasis. His latest solo album is called Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. When you sat down to write this record and began to sort of arrange it, what did you set out to do? What did you want this record to sound like?
I had a very clear idea that I wanted it to sound cinematic, but at the same time intimate and direct. It was very liberating. But when you're in a band and there's five of you, you have to accommodate five people in every song. And it became very difficult in Oasis, so everybody has to have their little bit. It was great just to free up everything and just the most direct songs you could just... There's no need for three or four guitars. It was just me and a voice and a guitar. Do you know what I mean? So the simple songs became very simple and the more elaborate ones became more elaborate. And I've had the best time making this record. You can't fight the feeling, and all is the same. The pouring rain, on the night, coming out of the ceiling, falling from above, falling in and out of love. Our broken heart is still beating.
Do you talk to other, you know, for lack of a better term, rock stars, about coping with what happens when you transition to...
Well, I mean, I was always of the opinion of, like, how hard can it be?
Right.
You know, people take music and their role in it so seriously.
Hmm.
And I think what I've tried to do is just take a step back and go, it's only music. And I kept saying this thing to myself when I was making the record. It's only a record. But everyone's like, oh, it's your first solo record. Oh, my God, what's he going to do? And it's like, but it's only a record. And if people don't like it, I'll make another one. So it's only a gig. You know, it's not like everybody's waiting for me to come up with the cure for cancer and me deliver it and it doesn't work. And everybody go, yeah, well, that didn't work. So, you know, see you later. It's like, it's only music. When we were actually the biggest bona fide band in the world, I never took that too seriously.
Mm.
Because it's a ludicrous position to be in.
Even though your songs were, I mean, life-changing for many, many people.
Yeah, but you see, it became to us so quickly that when Morning Glory blew up and it was on its 18 million sale and we were in the States, you know, America is a very corporate country and the American music business is very corporate. And they really didn't get what we were about as people because we'd... It was too soon from us being unemployed to being the biggest band in the world for us to care. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So we're kind of sat in these offices in New York. We'd only signed off unemployment benefit like 18 months before.
Wow.
So we're still in that mindset of like, this is just some giant party that we've gatecrashed somehow.
You are on tour, obviously, in the US right now. Are you performing Oasis material?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I'm not going to throw that stuff away.
Yeah.
When I was rehearsing for the tour, I played every single song off the album except one and all the B-sides. And I thought, well, that'll do. And I'll throw in a few Oasis numbers at the end. You know, I'm not gonna be let out of a venue without doing at least Don't Look Back in Anger. And we timed the set and it was like 38 minutes. And I was like, ooh, not going to be able to charge an extortionate amount of money for that. So I'm going to have to pad this out somehow.
Right.
And they're my songs. Oasis didn't write them.
Right.
I wrote those myself. All the words, all the arrangements, everything was written by me. So I don't feel guilty like I'm cheating on my girlfriend or something. You know. And I do like 7 or 8, but I'm not going to throw that stuff away. It's kind of me.
Talk to your brother, by the way, regularly?
Liam?
Yeah.
No, I spoke to him at Christmas.
Well, you guys always kind of, he's your younger brother, so presumably part of it is he looked up to you as a kid. And
I guess, I mean, I can't speak for Liam, do you know what I mean? But I can only, from my own view on it all, I was grateful for the dynamic that we had. I thought it was great. You know?
Does your mom ever intervene?
Oh, of course, all the time. She can't help but interfere. She's Irish, that's what she does. She gets up in the morning, she has breakfast, she sticks her nose into our That's what they do.
You sure she's not Jewish?
She could well have the Jewish gene in her.
Like my mom.
Yeah.
She gives you grief for not calling her.
It's a relentless... And what another thing my mom likes doing, bless her, is she'll call you up and say, remember such and such a person who lived next door when you were like 4 years old? And you go, no. And she'd go, yes, you do. Yes, you do. Her mother was not good with ginger hair. No, I really don't. Yes, you do. They had a big black dog called Bimbo. I really don't. Yes, you do. You used to knock around with their car, and it would go on for ages. So in the end, you just say yes, just to show up, and you go, oh, yes, that one. We say, yeah, well, she's dead. And you're like, right, well, this is 10 to 8 in the morning. That's a nice thought for the day. Is there anything else I can do for you? No.
That's Noel Gallagher. He's a founding member of the band Oasis. His latest solo record is called Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Noel Gallagher, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do
about you now. For the week ending April 1st, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Phil Harrell and edited by Muthoni Muturi. Our production staff includes Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Megan Kane, and Amy Held. Lauren Benishu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.